Lois's new book, The Suppressed Memoirs of Mabel Dodge Lujan, Sex, Syphilis, and Psychoanalysis in the Making of Modern American Culture, has just been published by University of New Mexico Press. Lois is Professor Emerita of American Studies, University of Massachusetts, Boston. And she is a resident, lucky for us, and your willingness to drive down from Santa Fe. Lois is also the author. She's the author of several books, one of them being Intimate Memories, the autobiography of Mabel Dodge Lujan. That was published in 2007 or earlier, and then
2007.
Yeah, 2007. As well as the author of Utopian Vistas, the Mabel Dodge Lujan House and the American Counterculture. It's from 1998. And she also published in 1987 Mabel Dodge Lujan, New Woman, New Worlds. So welcome, Lois. I'm so happy to meet you.
I'm happy to be here.
And Mabel Dodge Lujan has been a big part of your professional life. And I imagine as a writer, whether a character is real or imagined, that she, the character, spills over into your personal life too. So I'm wondering if that's true for you, especially with someone like Mabel Dodge Lujan.
Or to give you her full plenary of names, Mabel Ganson Evans Dodge Stern Lujan, maiden and four husbands. And it's impossible not to have lived with this woman for over 30 years and not have her affected my life. She is, in most ways, about as different from me as is conceivable. I led a very kind of straight life going through university, getting a PhD, teaching for 36 years at the university, and doing all the things that a professional woman does during the fortunate time that I grew up in the 1960s and 70s, or matured in the 1960s and 70s. Mabel was a much more conflicted woman who had a very different, came from a very different background and lifestyle, as we will talk about in a few minutes, I'm sure. And she allowed me to find New Mexico when I first started working on her as my doctoral dissertation topic.
When did you, so what got you interested in her in the first place?
I read an essay in a book called The New Radicals by Christopher Lash, The Intellectual as a Social Type. Lash chose six Americans from the progressive era, the early 20th century, who he thought were interesting characters and wrote essays about them. He titled the chapter on Mabel, Sex as Politics, and he claimed that Mabel was a 20th century pioneer in the cult of the orgasm. So when people ask me why I chose her as my doctoral dissertation topic, I'm fond of saying it just sounded so much more interesting than Moby Dick or Ralph Waldo Emerson or one of the white guys that I'd studied for most of my career in academia.
So that caught your attention.
It caught my attention. I could not have done a topic like this in an English department or a history department. The American Studies department at Brown was completely open. They had no idea who she was. She sort of had fallen off the map. But I went – there was a footnote in Lash's chapter that that pointed out that her 1,000 pounds of memoirs had been donated to Yale University in 1952. So I went down there just to look, and I started to read
– 1,000 pounds?
1,000 pounds.
Not 1,000 pages, but 1,000
pounds. 1,000 pounds, 20 volumes of memoirs, 17 scrapbooks, and thousands of pages of unpublished and published material. Obviously, I did not read all of it. In fact, this new book is about the fact that I could not read all of it, as we will get to at some point. And I just was hooked. Not partly it was Mabel, who is a fascinating character. Obviously, I wouldn't have stuck with her all these years if she weren't. But because she opened up worlds to me that I had known nothing about, I did not really know much about the radicals of Greenwich Village in the pre-war period. I didn't know anything about the expatriate community in Florence and at the turn of the 20th century. And I didn't even know where New Mexico was. To be very frank with you, I wasn't sure whether it was left or right of Texas when I first started doing my research. And I didn't actually get to come to New Mexico until I finished my dissertation. It took me nine years for my degree. And my parents gave me as a present a ticket to New Mexico. And I was hooked from the moment I got off the plane. I just loved it.
I'm glad I asked you that. That's such a wonderful story. And I would bet that most of the people listening right now have heard of Mabel Dodge Lujan. I bet most of the people who are listening right now could probably tell you a few things about her. But I also bet that some people in some of the things that you just said had no clue.
Right.
And so I want to ask you, although this is not exactly the intent of your visit today, to be brief and concise, I'm just curious, if I ask you to describe and get to the essence of Mabel Dodge Lujan in just a few sentences, what you can come up with spontaneously.
I would say that her most important role as an adult in life was being a cultural catalyst for creative genius, making spaces for men and women in the arts and politics. And she was unusual in that the collection of what she said, I'm a headhunter. And the people that she collected, she likes the best heads, the greatest heads that she can collect, crossed an enormous number of fields. They included dancers like Martha Graham, musicians, composers, and conductors like Leopold Stokowski, photographers like Ansel Adams and Paul Strand, painters like John Marin and Georgia O'Keeffe, writers like D.H. Lawrence and Willa Cather. These are a few of the scores of artists, writers, reformers like John Collier, who became really the first decent commissioner of Indian affairs in U.S. history and came out to New Mexico at Mabel's behest in the early 20s and fought for Native American rights for most of his life, that she created spaces for these people to come together, to work together, to be inspired by each other, sometimes because she was a very manipulative and difficult and bossy woman. She would tell people how to behave and what to do and what she wanted from them. And if they didn't, she would sometimes turn against them. She was very, very complicated. But I would say that aside from the four-volume, 1,600-page memoir she published, Intimate Memories, that I edited, which you mentioned, and the Winter in Taos, a beautiful memoir of her life in Taos with Tony, her greatest contribution to American culture was the ways in which she brought creative people together in Florence and then in New York City in Greenwich Village and then in Taos, New Mexico in her utopian commune.
What was it about her personality? Now, you said she could be very insistent, she could be bossy,
yes,
and controlling, but there must be other things,
right,
too, that could bring to
yes
together such a diverse group of individuals.
Absolutely. It certainly wasn't, as she was fond of saying, her beauty, because she was, for much of her life, overweight and not particularly beautiful, something that bothered her at that time. It matters just as much now to many women as it mattered at her time. She was extremely charismatic. She really knew how to listen to people and bring out the best and most interesting things in them. And that's indeed when Lincoln Steffen said to her, is the one who encouraged her to have a salon in New York. He said, you really know how to listen to people and bring out the best in them. Why don't you have a salon? All the important ideas of the day in terms of social justice, politics, feminism, sexuality can be discussed and debated. And she called it her free speech salon. So it had a lot to do with her having a terrific eye for who was interesting and important, who was making waves in the during the times in which she lived, her being very charismatic, her being wealthy and providing a lot of food and comfort and space for people, not so much in New York, more so in her 18-room home and her 5 guest houses in Taos, New Mexico.
When was this happening in New York? What years?
New York was 1912 to 1915. And when World War I broke out, she moved to Croton-on-Hudson in 1915 and eventually made it. She married her third husband, Maurice Stern, who was a post-impressionist painter, and sent him out to Santa Fe on their honeymoon. She was hoping that marriage might turn him from painter to sculptor. That was one of the many things she did, was maybe if I marry him. They'd been living together for 2 years as lovers. And he wrote her a letter that changed her life in November 1917, saying, dearest girl, you must come out here and save the Indians and tell the world about their art and culture. And she did. And she was there for 9 months, during which, for the first 9 months that she was there, she came to Santa Fe first, too crowded for her, wanted her own domain, went up to Taos, rented some apartments from Manby, and moved in on January 1st, 1918. Within 2 weeks, she was out of Taos Pueblo, She met Tony Lujan. She says that by 1918, she just basically told Marie Stern to go back to New York, and she and Tony became lovers. Marie said they had been lovers before, and he kept a gun under his pillow in case he had to play cowboy and Indians with Tony, who had parked his teepee in front of their apartments. So Tony is the one who showed her the land on which she built this beautiful house, which is at the end of Murata Lane off Kit Carson Road, and is a bed and breakfast and a retreat and conference center today, contiguous to 60,000 acres of Taos Pueblo land.
What a great person you chose to do research on and write on, because, you know, if you're at a cocktail party or wherever you may be, sometimes I think I don't have stories about myself to share, enough stories, but you have stories about this person who you've spent your life with researching and writing about,
yes,
that people are truly interested.
They are very interesting.
And it seems like more so as time goes by.
The Sturm und Drang around her and the number of stories and legends, she was both real and imagined. I would say that, you know, you asked me if I could summarize her in just a few brief sentences. I would say her other claim to fame, and of course I can't prove this, but I have read at least 20 or 30 novels and plays and poems in which Mabel is a character. She was appropriated by everybody from Gertrude Stein, who wrote a synthetic cubist portrait, a la Picasso about her when she stayed at her villa in Florence, to D.H. Lawrence, who had her heart cut out in a cave up in Arroyo Seco in one of his stories, so she could give everything back to the Indians. As you want the Indians to have everything? Here, sacrifice yourself. And that's what he does to the character he creates. And Mabel, in her typical way, when she read the story, said, "Well, Lawrence thought he got rid of me, but I'm still here."
If you just joined us, this is Women's Focus, and my name is Carol Boss. And if you haven't guessed, we're talking about Mabel Dodge Lujan. And it's Lois
Rudnick,
who is the author of The Suppressed Memoirs of Mabel Dodge Lujan, Sex, Syphilis, and Psychoanalysis in the Making of Modern American Culture. And yes, I have to read the title when I give you the name of the book. I can't do anything otherwise at this point. So you are you a or the biographer of Mabel Dodge Lujan?
Well, there's another biography by Emily Hahn. In fact, when I went down to Yale the first time, I called up Emily Hahn because I found out from the curator that she was under contract to Houghton Mifflin. And I called her and I said, "Miss Hahn, I'm here starting research on Mabel Dodge Lujan, but I don't want to write my thesis on her if you are going to be writing the definitive biography." And she said, "Oh, don't worry." She was British. "Oh, don't worry, dear. It will be a piece of fluff like my other books. You just go ahead."
Oh, she gave you her blessings and you ran with it.
Her blessings, and it was a piece of fluff. There were no footnotes. She really didn't like Mabel. Most of what was in that book came out of gossip.
Oh, that's lucky for you, really.
Well, but there were some helpful things in there that I wouldn't have known, because she was allowed to read papers that I wasn't. They were restricted right after she left the library doing her research.
So the suppressed memoirs, the restricted memoirs, that was the doing of her family?
It was the doing of her family because of Emily Hahn. Emily Hahn was sitting in the Beinecke Library at Yale one day with Ellen Bradbury, who's a well-known citizen of Santa Fe, the director of Recursos, a cultural institute program. And Ellen was starting to write a thesis on Mabel, which she didn't finish. And she gave Emily a document she was reading called The Statue of Liberty, a story of taboos. Emily's reading it, and she shrieks out in the Beinecke reading room, "Syphilis!" And all heads turn.
This is a story of Mabel.
This is a story of Ellen. Takes place in 1973, in the winter sometime.
But the story they were reading.
The story they were reading was written by Mabel Dodge Lujan, yes. And when she shrieked syphilis, people turned around to look. They called the curator over. They showed the curator what they were reading. He called Mabel's son, her only child, John Evans, from her first husband, and said, "Do you want scholars reading your mother's papers about syphilis?" And he said, "I give you the authority to restrict until the year 2000 any papers having to do with sexuality or sexual disease about my mother." And so they did. And I went down in the year 2000 when the papers were open. I think I was there January 2nd or 3rd. I went down because I just was curious about what I was not allowed to know. I knew from Emily Hahn's biography that Tony had infected Mabel with syphilis. But I did not know until I went down to Yale. And I had actually read something a couple of years before, which opened up this whole story to me. I don't know why it was open, but it was. The three of her four husbands had syphilis, and her first lover, who was a married doctor in Buffalo, while she was married, they were having a tempestuous affair, gave her gonorrhea. And at the end of this very last memoir she wrote, Doctors, 50 Years of Experience, in 1954, she asked the question, can there be so much venereal disease in the world? And that sent me off on a 5-year quest to find out the ways in which venereal disease had infected and affected Western culture in Europe and the United States, with particularly its ramifications upon women.
That's amazing. So you had no idea after deciding that you were going to be researching and writing on Mabel Dodge Lujan that you were ever going to go in this direction.
No, I had no idea. And I was absolutely flabbergasted by the cultural, social, political, economic impact that venereal disease had on every aspect of European and American life in the 19th and 20th century. I mean, it goes back to purportedly Columbus bringing venereal disease home as the gift from the Indians he had conquered and brought diseases to from Europe, because the first major outbreaks happen and are written about and are seen in 1495. But by the time Mabel is born in 1879 to an upper-class, you know, Victorian Gilded Age family, two miserable parents who hate each other and pay no attention to her, what I call upper-class child abuse, she has no memories of ever being touched by either of her parents. Which created an enormous emotional vacuum in her. At the time she was born, the Victorian euphemism was that the sins of the fathers would be inflicted on their children unto the third and fourth generation. And what that meant was is that any man who brought syphilis home to his wife would not only infect her potentially, but children and grandchildren. That wasn't true. A woman who was infected could give birth to a baby with congenital syphilis, which was horrific. I mean, they could be blind, they could die in utero or after birth and have terrible birth defects, but you could not get, they would not manifest symptoms of syphilis in their teens or 20s or anything like that. But that was the belief. She writes about that a lot in her suppressed memoirs. I don't know if her father was syphilitic. But he was told after her mother gave birth to her never to sleep with her mother again because it made him insane.
Mm.
And he may have been homosexual. His antipathy towards sexuality frightened her from the time she was a child. He was an angry, rageful man. He might have been suffering from tertiary syphilis, which is the final stage of it. And he told her, she says, I grew up believing that whatever it was that men and women did, that it was all mixed up with sin and punishment. And even though she became an ultra-modern woman who believed that all women were free to do, be, and say whatever they want, she never quite got over that Victorian sense of being doomed by, or in some ways, having to be punished for a fate that she in no way had anything to do with.
Sounds like there was a lot of reconciling, inner reconciliation that she was doing.
Well, she was
very
attempting.
Confused
she
messages.
She had totally conflicting messages. And, you know, growing up and growing to become an advocate of Freud, some of the first public lectures on Freudian psychoanalysis took place in her salon in New York. And she became, if Mabel did anything, she did it to the nth and most extreme degree. And what Freud was telling women is, you, to be a proper woman, to be a whole woman, you need to fulfill yourself as a wife and mother. Otherwise, you know, you are not going to be able to complete yourself. Freud was a deeply Victorian patriarchal man whose theory in some ways was liberating to women, because it took nervous disorders, as they were called, a neurasthenia, seriously. Doctors before him would take women like Mabel and put them, incarcerate them, and, you know, feed them, put them in the dark, tell them they couldn't write or read books. Charlotte Perkins Gilman writes about this in her brilliant short story, The Yellow Wallpaper, where a wife is essentially imprisoned in a nursery in a doctor's house because she has postpartum depression and infantilized and not allowed to think or read because it was the woman's mind that was creating the hysteria in the uterus, was the 19th century belief. At least the talking cure took women seriously, but it reified, I mean, it reinforced the same old gender ideas about women having to be fulfilled through wife and motherhood. And Mabel both believed that completely, and it was totally the opposite of everything she yearned to do and her personality. She wanted to create. She wanted to be strong and powerful. And so one of the things I found in these papers were the case notes from her first psychoanalysis in 1916, which are stunning, and the letter she wrote to her psychiatrist, which are – her Smith Eli Jelliffe, who was a Freudian, which are utterly amazing.
Give us an idea of some of the stunning things that you uncovered.
One of the stunning things that one of these letters reveals, and I just read it last night at a talk I gave in Santa Fe, and it never ceases to make people gasp, is her writing to Jelliffe that he has helped her to understand that the reason she has not been able to have good relationships with men is that she uses her femaleness in a male way and her maleness in a female way. And rather than lying prone under the revered phallus, she has tried to control the sexual act and therefore has not been able to get pregnant. Psychoanalysis, she put – these are her words – has trained her orgasm to go into her vagina where it belongs, because psychoanalysis says that's where it belongs.
Wow.
Yes.
So you make us gasp.
It's quite a letter.
Wow. And yet she's kind of the symbol of, the part of the title of your of her autobiography is New Woman, right?
Right. Of my first biography is New Woman, New World.
Right.
And she was. She
and
lived
sexually emancipated.
She lived openly in New York with John Reed, who was 6 years younger than she was. She got a doctor's note to get her husband.
Oh, she lived with the revolutionary John
right,
Reed?
Right. The revolutionary John Reed, who founded the first American Communist Party. She came back from Europe with her second husband, Edwin Dodge, who had bought her a Medician villa in Florence after Gertrude Stein told her, enough of the Renaissance in the past. You are a modern woman and you should be living in New York at the center of where the avant-garde is. Of course, Paris is – Stein's in Paris while she's telling Mabel this and stays there for the most part. And Mabel gets a doctor's note saying that Edwin's making her sick. He apologizes to her. He was a very lovely man, other than the fact he had syphilis. And he leaves, and she takes up with John Reed. She becomes vice president for the Armory Show, the first major international modern art exhibition in the United States. She writes for the Masses magazine, which John Reed is an editor for. They have a tempestuous love affair. He is, like all the other men she marries or doesn't, unfaithful to her with other women. She becomes this kind of figure that women look up to as someone who has chosen how to live her own life and determined her own fate. And at the same time, she is completely emotionally dependent on whatever man she's living with.
Yeah. It's not an unfamiliar story.
No, it is not an unfamiliar story. It's still with us today.
I want to go back to Gertrude Stein since you mentioned her. So who's more influential and powerful, Gertrude Stein or Mabel Dodge Lujan, and were they rivals ever? Because here is the influential, or maybe she wasn't quite at that point yet when Gertrude Stein was giving her advice, but here she is bringing all these people together, and certainly Gertrude Stein
right.
did that, and Gertrude Stein telling her where to live and how to live.
Exactly. Gertrude Stein and Mabel were two peas in a pod. Uh-huh. They were exceedingly narcissistic and egomaniacal. Mabel did suffer from manic depression, and I can't claim that for Gertrude Stein. And so part of her – these kind of projects to change the world, to recreate the Renaissance, to bring social justice and free sex to the United States or make the Pueblo Indians the center of a new world plan for Americans who were too materialistic or individualistic. Part of it came from these manic moments she had when she thought, as people do when they're in their manic phase, who are bipolar, that she could do anything. And she suffered from horrific depression. She was suicidal. She began to cut herself when she was a child because she had nothing in terms of like emotional love or affection, physical or any other way from her family other than one grandmother. And so she's a more complicated person in some ways than Gertrude. But she is the one who first made Gertrude known in the United States. When the Armory show opened, Mabel took the essay that Gertrude wrote about her, Mabel Dodge at the Villa Caronia, and had it bound in Florentine wallpaper and had thousands of copies given away free at the Armory show, and then people started to pick up on it, Carl Van Vechten and others, and write about Stein. Stein ended their friendship when she thought that Mabel was getting too much acclaim and too much media attention, and they never really spoke again, though Mabel tried several times to contact her.
This is Women's Focus that you're listening to. My name is Carol Boss, and with me is Lois Rudnick, and she is author of the new book from University of New Mexico Press, The Suppressed Memoirs of Mabel Dodge Lujan, Sex, Syphilis, and Psychoanalysis in the Making of Modern American Culture. You'll have the opportunity to, if you want to meet Lois and hear her read from her book, she will be at Bookworks, I think it is this Tuesday evening, the 28th.
Mm-hmm.
What time does it?
7 o'clock.
And that's on Rio Grande Boulevard, just immediately north of Griegos. And then I think it's on Saturday, 2 weeks from, well, actually,
September 29th,
you will be at Somos.
I will be at the Mabel Dodge Lujan House.
Oh.
And Somos is sponsoring it along with the Mabel Dodge House. And I'll be doing a lecture and a slideshow there and a book signing at 7 o'clock as well.
So these restricted, suppressed memoirs that seem to have happened by a chance occurrence in a library of someone yelling out the word
syphilis.
Ellen from Santa Fe? Syphilis.
It was Emily Hahn, who apparently. And this is all from Ellen. So I have this story, I guess,
I
secondhand.
And all eyes turn. There's probably a hushed silence in the room. And then the son is called up of Mabel, and I guess it sounds like he decides, as you told it, right then and there, they will be restricted until some year he pulled out of his hat, which is 2000.
Right. He did pull it out of his hat, but I think the assumption was is that by 2000, anyone who might be concerned would be dead at that point. So no, he wouldn't have to, including himself, and he did die in 1977, so he was well dead by the time the papers were open.
Oh, yeah. So we were talking about over 30 years that it would be suppressed.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. So then, did you feel like you were in hog heaven?
This book.
Were you waiting for this date?
I was waiting, and I was waiting in anticipation, but not in anticipation of writing another book. And in fact, this is the hardest book I've ever had to write. It took me 10 years on and off. I did other books and other projects not related to Mabel. But because these memoirs, the 20 volumes of them, were so disparate, because I had to figure out a way to make a kind of coherent story out of them, because I became so obsessed with the impact of venereal disease on modern art, literature, the women's rights movement, the eugenics movement, immigration policy, and everything else over a 50-year period, my original introduction was 150 pages. And it took me a long time and my wonderful editor, Beth Hattis from UNM Press, to say, Lois, you can't write a 150-page introduction to these memoirs. So she helped me make something far more controllable, and it came out being a book that I'm exceedingly proud of. But I wrestled with it for years.
I've got to play a couple of announcements, and we're going to come back and talk more right here on Women's Focus. I'm really sorry about that. Somebody just called to say that we've been having issues about being off the air over the last several weeks, and I'll be honest, everything looked fine in here, and I could tell somebody's been trying to call for the last 20 minutes, and I got really concerned that there was something amiss, and that's why I wound up answering the phone when I played those messages before.
It was Mabel. I can just tell you
that
for sure.
Mabel?
It was Mabel.
Like, right, but yeah, that's Mabel. So we're here. And I also want to tell you something else before we get back talking, Lois and myself, that KUNM has a two-week archive. And if you've missed some of this program or if you know someone else who is interested in hearing it, this show, as well as all of our programs, will be up for 2 weeks from the initial airing. So beginning 20 minutes after this show ends at 2 o'clock, the show will be available for you if you know somebody who would like to listen. And I'm going to also really try hard in this next week or so to get some of the interviews I've done that people have requested up on KUNM's website as podcasts, which is including this one as well. So I'm also going to ask, if you can hear me now, not to call. Because when I see the light flashing that there's a phone call, I get a little nervous because of some of the things that have happened over the last couple of weeks. So just hang up. I can't talk to you on the phone right now. And I'm going to trust the listener who said that we are coming across loud and clear. Okay, Lois, I really apologize.
Oh, there's nothing to apologize for.
That's what happens with live
radio.
You know, we just have to take care of business here.
It's Mabel the mischief maker.
Okay. Like I think that's a good idea to blame it on Mabel. So in terms of you finally having access in 2000 after almost maybe 30 years of her memoirs being, mm-hmm. part of her memoirs being restricted, you just told us that you worked on the book for 10 years.
On and off, yes.
One of the hardest things for you to do.
Yeah.
And UNM Press told you you cannot write.
Well, my darling editor, Beth Haddis, who's been my editor since my first Mabel biography, I sent the manuscript to her and I said, I don't know what to do with this. And she just wrote me back two paragraphs and she said, do this, this, this. And I did it and it worked.
Do this, this, and that.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of writers out there that might want to know what the this, this, and this is. The tips that made it. Yeah, good.
Exactly.
Good for you. So what kind of response have you gotten to the publication?
Well, I have been truly amazed by the response. I mean, the book just came out at the end of July, and I've had a couple of experiences meeting people who have read it and giving talks. My first talk was at the Creativity and Madness Conference in Santa Fe, which happens every summer. It's a group. It's an organization that brings psychotherapists and psychiatrists from all over the country to get 2 years' worth of, I think they're called CEUs. And the topics can be anything as long as creativity and psychology are connected in some way. So it ranges from Mozart to talking about death to talking about Mabel Dodge Lujan. And the response from this group, there were 450
How
people.
How fascinating.
Oh, it's very interesting. The response from this group was extraordinary. They loved it, and it made me feel terrific about the psychoanalytic part, since I'm not an historian of psychoanalysis. I certainly researched it, but that no one said to me, there's something, anything you said that doesn't sound correct in terms of what you're talking about when you talk about early Freud and early Freudian analysis. Last night, I gave a talk to about 200 people at St. Francis Auditorium, and an hour before my lecture, a woman ran up to me with the book and said, I've just finished this 12 minutes ago, and I couldn't leave my house all day or do any errands because I couldn't put it down. I've gotten two great reviews, one in Publishers Weekly, one in Pasa Tiempo, the Santa Fe New Mexican Friday Arts Magazine yesterday. So I hope it continues because it's been wonderful so far.
Well, I've got to tell you, to have an audience of 200 people to come and hear you talk, that's pretty darn substantial.
That's great. It was great, yes.
Oh, so maybe the buzz is growing here. Wow. So you would say that Mabel Dodge Lujan then was essentially on the cusp of the transformation or the transition from the Victorian, mm-hmm. era to our modern,
right.
age.
That's one of the reasons I think I chose her as a subject. This was the first question you asked me. How does she sort of relate to my own personal life? She grew up in the Victorian era. She was deeply molded by that period of time, by a deeply conservative and unloving family, as I have said, and you know, and her class and her place in time, women were supposed to grow up to stand next to men and make them shine. They were supposed to be great hostesses, make, you know, elaborate dinner parties. Well, at least their cooks and their maids would make them. They certainly wouldn't dirty their hands. And she rebelled against that from the time that she was a little child. She was what we would have called, we called in my day, a tomboy. She grows up into a modern world where the men and women are asking questions about love, sexuality, balancing family and career, about how they can change a world where there is dramatic difference between wealth and poverty, like the world, like the United States we're living in today. And I never heard of these people, but I grew up in the conservative domestic 50s in a middle-class family where I was expected to go to college, which, of course, Mabel was not, though there were many women in her generation, but a small proportion of women who went did go to college. I was expected to go to college, but as my mother said to me, I don't care what you do with your life as long as you get married and have a baby. And my father said, you can be whatever you want. So I did both so I could satisfy both my parents. And I sort of felt that the transition from the 50s, growing up in this very closed era, you know, the suburban mom, you're supposed to have three or four children. You're supposed to, you know, it, Rosie the Riveter goes home from World War II. She comes back. And she's supposed to kind of give up all those freedoms where she had her own job and her own money and, you know, essentially sacrifice her life to schlepping, as we say in Yiddish, her children around to different lessons and being a thoughtful, quiet ear when her tired husband comes home from work. And that was who she was. Her identity was whoever she was, Mrs. X. I remember my first getting my first credit card when I married in 1965, and it was Mrs. Stephen Rudnick. I'm still married to the same man 47 years later. And it, I never thought about, why isn't this credit card in my own name? I was completely oblivious to this. The only experience I'd ever had of overt sexual discrimination was in my senior year of college when the chair of my English department called me in. I was married in my junior year of college, and I had to get permission from my family, and I had to sign a document saying I would reveal no marital secrets to women in the dorms. This is 1965, mm-hmm. Tufts University, not a Catholic or, you know, religious college, but a upstanding, you know, progressive liberal arts college on the East Coast. I walk into the chair's office my senior year. He said, I would like to recommend you for a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship for graduate school, but I can't. And I said, why not? He said, because you're married and they won't give it to you because it's not, you know, they don't think it's worth giving a fellowship to a married woman because she's just going to get pregnant and not finish her degree. And so I said, oh, I thought nothing of it. It didn't even make me angry. I just walked out of his office. And it wasn't really until I started reading feminist literature and feminist movement is really kind of getting its legs on in the late 60s that I began to think back. And I joined a women's committee of my national professional association, and we did a survey of women in the profession about how they'd been treated by their advisors. And those letters that came in were just knocked my socks off. And I said, here it is, Mabel and her generation of women are asking the same questions that we're asking. You know, how can you be equal and can you be free and also have a loving, intimate relationship? Can you both be a professional woman and have a family and raise a family? And so I became fascinated by the parallels. I mean, it's a different world, but there are still parallels.
Well, it sounds really interesting in terms of the timeline that I think I'm hearing that it sounds like right before maybe that you discovered Mabel Dodge Lujan, that you were now coming into your own and thinking along these lines, the same lines. And then there she is. But
I will have to say that there were many feminist women who were appalled that I was writing about Mabel Dodge Lujan. This was another very interesting facet of working on her. I remember going to conferences and people always ask each other, what are you working on? And I said, I'm writing about Mabel Dodge Lujan. And I remember one scholar who shall remain unnamed looking at me like with eyes askance. Well, she was male identified, wasn't she? And I said, yes, but most women are male identified. They choose males as heterosexual partners. Mabel had had several lesbian experiences in her teenage years up through her 30s, and I think gave them up because Freud was insistent that people who were not normative sexually, that is heterosexual, were cases, as Mabel was fond of putting it, of arrested development. But I was absolutely taken aback by this, and I was castigated for writing about a woman who wasn't a real heroine, who was difficult, who came into New Mexico as a cultural imperialist and, you know, took over the Indians and was essentially selling this romantic vision of northern New Mexico, which is a tremendously poor place, to the world, and helping to bring people here who painted romantic pictures of New Mexico, and so in some way was implicated with the continuing disparity of income and the conflicts among and between Native Americans, Hispanos, and Anglos. And Mabel definitely chose the Indians over Hispanos. She wrote a piece in the early 20s about the Santo collection. She had a wonderful Santo collection that she donated to the Harwood in 1925 or so. And she wrote a kind of Freudian analysis of the Penitentes that was published in Spanish in El Crepusculo. And I've learned this from her new papers. And many of the Penitente Brotherhood went to the Marauder behind her house. And a friend of hers, who was a friend of theirs, said, "You better get out. They might burn your house down. They're really angry at you for saying that they use self-flagellation as a kind of way to a catharsis for their pain and suffering and sense of doom. They are furious that you would write this kind of piece for an Eastern audience." And she said, "Well, I never thought anybody back here would read this. I mean, I don't even know how they got hold of it." So there are reasons to critique her. And in fact, one of the most interesting pieces I've ever had to write is something called The Male Identified Woman and Other Problems of a Feminist Biographer. And it was for a wonderful book about writing women's lives. And the book was about why 10 of us, all biographers of women, chose our subjects and the impact it had on our lives. And I talked about the 10 reasons one should never write about Mabel Dodge Lujan, tongue in cheek, because I, you know, the idea that she was rich is that she should be critiqued because she was wealthy, that she should be critiqued because she wasn't a nice woman. I said, "Do we say this about Picasso? Do we ask that?" I taught Hemingway for 35 years. He was an absolute SOB to the women in his lives, to most of them. And I said, "We do not hold men who are creative to the same standards to which we hold women. Why do I have to write about someone who is nice? Why do I have to write about someone who was only heroic, who wasn't problematic?" Even Emma Goldman, whom I adore, the anarchist Emma Goldman, who was a good friend of Mabel's, was a complete mess in her love life with the men that she picked as her partners. So I said, to me, Mabel is more like, though in a very extreme form, more like most women of her generation and to some extent our own generation, who can never come to terms with how much of themselves to give to their men and their families or even to have them, and how much they should give to their own self-development and self-realization.
So Lois Rudnick, is there a life after Mabel Dodge Lujan?
Yeah. Last night, Joe Traugott introduced me. He said, "And Mabel's alter ego, Lois Rudnick." And I have a friend who's a Jungian therapist who says she's my dark shadow side. There's always been life with and after, because I had a full, rich life as an academic and a director of chair of a department. And I've written many other things. But she has been a significant part of my life, for good or ill, I guess people could say.
Right. Do you have a website?
I don't. I'm not very technologically adept.
I couldn't find a website, so I thought if I couldn't find it, then I don't think you
know. No, there's no website.
Is there, technically we have a few minutes left. So is there something from your book, I don't know if you brought it with you, but I have
it. I didn't.
That is brief, that is, will capture listeners?
Sure. If you want to give me the book,
I'm going to walk over and give you the book. Okay. And the book that we're talking about is The Suppressed Memoirs of Mabel Dodge Lujan. How many of you out there can remember the subtitle? Sex, Syphilis, and Psychoanalysis in the Making of Modern American Culture.
Okay.
How was this? I know we've it's been covered a little bit, but I was going to ask for another example of how it helped make modern American culture. But that's an open-ended question, so I think I'm going to skip
You can
that.
Read my book and find out the ways in which venereal disease affected Picasso, Dalí, Munch, D.H. Lawrence, not necessarily that they all had it, but in terms of the way in which it permeated the writing and the art that they did. It's really quite astonishing. And you can also find out one of the most interesting parallels I found, and maybe that's what I will read at the end of my introduction, is the parallel between Mabel Dodge Lujan and Isak Dinesen. So let me see if I can find that, because that's very short. Should have thought of this ahead of time.
Oh, we're being spontaneous.
Here we go. All right. Here we go. Edge of Taos Desert was Mabel's, I'm sorry, Isak Dinesen's biographer, Judith Thurman, called Out of Africa a sublime repair job. Published the same year as Mabel's Edge of Taos Desert, 1937, they can both be categorized as syphilis memoirs. Like Mabel, Isak erases most of the pain, messiness, and distress of her life in her Kenyan farm, including administering salvarsan to her African workers, many of whom were infected with syphilis. Her creation myth of Africa as paradise, which she believed she was one of the last white Europeans to discover, in quotes, was very much a recreation in memory of what she had lost in life. Dinesen came to Africa with a mind steeped in Rousseauian views of the noble savage. These were implanted by her father, who had apparently lived among American Indians, and never tired of reminding her as a child that, in his words, Indians are better than our civilized people of Europe. They are closer to nature, more honest. Their eyes see more than ours, and they are wiser. We should learn more from them. Edge of Taos Desert was Mabel's divine repair job, the teleological end to her autobiographical mission. Like Dinesen, she erased syphilis from her memoir, ending her story before her discovery that syphilis was rampant in Taos Pueblo and before Tony infected her with it. Like Dinesen, she created a myth of Taos as a paradise, the key difference between them being that Mabel ended her four volumes of published memoirs with her having regained paradise, whereas Dinesen wrote in an elegiac mode from a perspective after the fall.
All right. Thank you, Lois Rudnick. And for those of you who are interested, you can hear Lois this Tuesday evening, August 28th at 7 o'clock at Bookworks on Rio Grande Boulevard. Again, that's just north of, it's in Flying Star Plaza, I think it's called. It's just north of Griegos. And then September 29th, which will be a Saturday, you're going to be at the Mabel Dodge Lujan House at 7 p.m. In Taos.
Yes.
So that sounds great. It's been delightful to have you on. I had no idea who you were, how you would be on the radio, and I've had a great time having you as
a
guest.
Thank you. I have too. Thanks so much, Carol.
Yeah, you're most welcome. And this is Women's Focus right here at KUNM. Once again, we are at KUNM.org. We stream live all the time, and it is a great place to hear our programs if you want to hear them again or if you've missed something that you want to hear. It's 2-week archives at kunm.org.